You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's been a year since the Inflation Reduction Act was passed, with climate change measures as part of the package. Check out the latest debates about how to use that environmental funding. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, the U.S. women's national soccer team was recently eliminated from the World Cup during a round of 16 match against Sweden. The U.S. lost during a penalty kick shootout after 120 minutes of play left them tied 0-0 with Sweden. It was the team's earliest ever exit from the World Cup. While many fans were disappointed, some conservative commentators celebrated the loss on social media and elsewhere. Here's talk show host Megyn Kelly.
Longtime team leader and activist Megan Rapinoe was smiling and laughing to herself after missing the crucial penalty kick. It was overall just an embarrassing performance for this team from the start. They donned the uniforms of the United States of America, but they refused to honor anything we stand for. And therefore, I'm thrilled they lost. Good. I'm glad you went down. You don't support America, I don't support you. And I know I'm not alone.
Other conservative figures shared the sentiment, including former President Trump, who taunted star forward Megan Rapinoe for missing her penalty kick and said, quote, woke equals failure. This isn't the first time U.S. women's soccer players have faced criticism for their political views and activism. And according to our guest today, it's part of a broader trend of women athletes facing extra scrutiny on and off the field. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you rooting for or against the U.S. women's soccer team? Did it have anything to do with their political and social views expressed by the team as a whole, by individual members? What do you think about athletes, current, former athletes, expressing themselves politically? Do you want to see more of it, less of it? Why? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Cheryl Cookie is a professor of American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Purdue University. She's the co-author of Serving Equality, Feminism, Media, and Women's Sports, and of No Slam Dunk, Gender, Sport, and the Unevenness of Social Change. Cheryl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Glad to be here.
First of all, Cheryl, can you talk about the kinds of social or political activism that we've seen from the U.S. Women's soccer community over the years that these conservative commentators are criticizing?
Yeah, I think I can't speak to exactly what the conservative commentators are directly focused on, although I have my own thoughts on that. But I think when we look at the women's soccer team, certainly over the last 4 or 5 years, but even going back as far as probably even then the early iterations of the World Cup team back in the 90s, the team itself has been focused on equal pay, inequality in women's soccer, both at the national team level and sort of globally as well, right? And so I think when we look at kind of the activism of these athletes, it really has, I think, most visibly been centered on equal pay and being treated equally, receiving comparable compensation, comparable travel, other kinds of resources that the men's national team receives. And certainly we can have a broader conversation about that. I think the other kind of piece of political activism by some members of the U.S. women's national team has really revolved around social justice, and in particular supporting the Black Lives Matter movement from a few years back. And I think we see that most visibly in the media with Megan Rapinoe as one of the kind of first athletes outside of women's basketball, men's basketball, and football to start joining Colin Kaepernick in his kneeling during the national anthem in response to police brutality and other forms of social injustice faced by Black and brown communities.
Now, the quote I mentioned from former President Trump seemed to equate woke, as the word is used, with failure. Is there any sense that this team is any more politically or socially active than they were 4 years ago when they won the World Cup, 8 years ago when they won the World Cup? Can we say that there's any connection between their political and social activism and their success on the field?
I don't think there's any connection. I think that this is part of a larger conservative strategy to use women's sports as a cultural wedge. And I don't necessarily believe that conservative commentators, those who are kind of posting online, are really invested one way or another in this particular issue outside of just a way to kind of mobilize a base. And certainly the language that's being used very much taps into kind of larger dynamics within kind of conservative political strategies around sort of demonizing any type of efforts or movements that address social inequality, particularly around race, around gender, around sexuality and sexual orientation. And so I think this is women's sports for me as a scholar who's been studying this for the last several decades, is really occupying a unique space within the culture of kind of being the center point for this kind of larger political strategy around again, mobilizing, you know, base voters. And so what's striking to me, though, Rob, in all of this is the kind of ways in which the U.S. women's national team were celebrated in previous World Cups when they won. And certainly, as we mentioned at the top of the segment here, you know, they were very much involved in equal pay, equality, social justice kinds of issues at that time. And they were embraced by, I think, all Americans. I was actually doing some research looking at media coverage on sport news, televised highlight shows. And in fact, ESPN spent quite some time covering the final game of the women's tournament. And the graphics and the commentator itself was very much draped in a kind of, you know, USA patriotism, red, white, and blue graphics that sort of accompanied a lot of stories on different networks. The women were talked about as being, you know, kind of patriotic. And I think this is interesting and part of a larger trend in the research, which is that when women's sports are just kind of in the day-to-day, everyday coverage, we might not see them sort of make it in the headlines, you know, on the highlights and so on. But certainly when women, whether it's the Olympics, whether it's the World Cup, whether it's sort of major Grand Slam tournaments, when women are participating in those major international competitions, the media coverage certainly spikes. And oftentimes it's really driven by a kind of national pride and kind of nationalism or nationalist sort of sentiment. And so this to me seems much, it's more distinct than the kind of previous ways that we've seen women's sports talked about, at least within this particular segment of kind of conservative media spaces.
Talking to Cheryl Cookey from Purdue University, author of No Slam Dunk, Gender, Sport, and the Unevenness of Social Change, talking about the U.S. women's soccer team, their exit from the World Cup, criticism, especially from conservatives over political and social stances taken by the team and by members of that team. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Cheryl, going back a long time, men and women's sports, I think sometimes we hear the idea, you know, I go to sports, someone might say to not think about politics and difficult social issues, and people kind of concerned when those issues find their way into sports. This has been going on for decades, of course. What are your thoughts about that idea of keeping politics one way or another out of our sports?
I think that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that sports studies scholars and I've seen other sports journalists talk about this as well is the ways in which politics has been inherently a part of sports, you know, since in some ways the kind of origins of modern sports in the United States. And we see that particularly during Olympic years, right? The kind of idea that athletes, American athletes, are representing the nation. The idea that sort of politics infuses sports, I think, really became very strikingly visible in the sort of post 9/11 moment, right, where we saw a tremendous shift in terms of the sort of influx of a kind of patriotic and celebration of the United States, celebration of the military, right, become infused in the ways in which sports, and in particular men's football, baseball, and basketball, were kind of packaged and sold to consumers, right? So we start to see the national anthem being played consistently during games, people standing for the anthem, the large American flags that are draped across football, entire football fields, the kind of military appreciation nights. All of these things are sort of examples that scholars point to sort of talk about the ways that a particular kind of politics becomes infused in the ways that sports are presented, in the ways that sports are broadcast, in terms of how we're expected to show and demonstrate pride as fans, as players, as spectators. And so I think the idea or the notion that sports is somehow devoid of politics is somewhat countered in that. And I'm thinking specifically around the report that came out, I think it was back in 2014, and this was a report that was published by Senators Jeff Flake and John McCain, who were looking into the ways in which government spending was being used to support these military appreciation events and the ways in which taxpayer money was being funneled into the kind of patriotic displays that were happening in sporting events. And as a fan or as a viewer, you might be sitting at home and thinking like, oh, well, this is great. The NFL is celebrating our military. And in fact, what this was a very kind of concerted strategy, whereby, taxpayer money was going to, support these events and essentially going into the pockets of these leagues. And so I think that when we look to those particular examples, again, particularly in the 9/11, post 9/11 moment, we see politics and a particular kind of politics become very much infused in the sport landscape. The kind of politics that aren't welcome in sport, though, are the kind of politics where athletes are advocating for things like social justice, equality, addressing social issues around, poverty in Black communities. If we go as far back to the 1968 Olympics and the Black Power protests by Tommy Smith and John Carlos, right? So, I hope that's enough evidence, sure, maybe to convince some viewers that really politics is kind of part and parcel of sports. And so when we say, I don't want politics in sports, I think we have to ask the question, well, which kind of politics are we talking about here?
We're talking to Cheryl Cookey, professor at Purdue University, who studies the gender politics of sports, about the recent conservative political backlash against the U.S. women's national soccer team, who faced an early elimination from the World Cup last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you following the team? Did you like when the team and its members took social and political stances? Did you dislike it? Did it not affect you one way or the other as you watched the games, followed them from afar? Do you think athletes should weigh in on politics and social issues? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the U.S. team's recent elimination from the World Cup and women athletes facing scrutiny for political activism. Our guest is Cheryl Cookey, professor of American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Purdue University, author of a couple of books on related topics. You can join at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to the U.S. women's national team's loss at the World Cup? What other highlights from the tournament affected you? What do you think about the politics around all of this? Does it matter to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Susan is with us in Rhinelander. Susan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, just listening to the speaker today, and I was saying I had not heard that soundbite from Megyn Kelly, and hearing it, it really explains why I had seen such a backlash on social media against the team. I'm sure she wasn't alone. But that type of vitriol and that anger, I guess I would just ask, where does that stem from? You know, we all have differing opinions. That's the beauty of our country. We all have our First Amendment rights. And to put that kind of vitriol out there in the public space, where does that stem from? I don't get it, and I just think it's so detrimental.
Susan, thanks for the call. Cheryl, what do you think?
Yeah, Susan, thank you for calling in. That's a great question. I asked myself that question as well. Certainly, you know, my colleagues in political science might be better suited to sort of think about and talk about the ways that politics in the United States has become so polarizing. What really sort of strikes me about that soundbite, though, Susan, is, you know, it's, and I wrote it down, you know, they don't honor anything that we stand for. And to me, I step back and say, okay, well, what is the team standing for? The team stands for equal pay, paying men and women the same amount of money for doing the same type of job. Some of the players stand for equality in terms of giving the same human rights to people who are from marginalized communities, whether we're talking about Black and brown American citizens, whether we're talking about LGBTQ individuals, American citizens, whether we're talking about trans communities and trans American citizens. I mean, these are the kinds of issues that the team is advocating around and is engaged in activism around. And so to me, I think, how is that not about what we as Americans stand for? And so I think going back to a point I made earlier in the segment, I'm not sure if this is really about a kind of investment in women's sports by some of these conservative commentators. Again, I think this is part of a larger conservative strategy to mobilize the base and issues around women's sports. I mean, and particularly trans inclusion in sports is a real kind of hotbed issue right now. That has definitely been effective in from a kind of political strategical standpoint, right? In really rallying the base in ways that maybe other social issues are no longer as effective at. So, you know, Susan, I think that's a great question, and you know, I think it's unfortunate that we're in this this moment, and that the fact that, you know, these are athletes who are just trying to play the game that they love, and do what they've been, you know, working hard to do on this sort of elite international platform, and to come back to the United States and to have that kind of reception, I think is really somewhat discouraging. And the thing that I worry about is, like, what messages do young girls and young boys and young, you know, athletes of all kinds of genders, what kind of messages do they take away from that treatment of women athletes?
Thanks for that call, Susan. We'll go to Andrew now in Oconomowoc. Andrew, hi.
Well, hi, yeah. So I have maybe a little bit of a question and a comment. I've been an athlete all my life, and especially over the years, it's more and more important to stay focused on my event. So I don't want to have to worry about if my teammates or I need to kneel or think of anything political. I just want to concentrate on that day's game and performance and do the best job I possibly can. And I got to ask, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, I think sports is a very good distraction for anybody watching them. They can escape the world. And when some of the athletes started making it political, then there was this outcry, whether it's from conservatives or anybody. I think you're wrong when you say this is a conservative issue versus a liberal issue.
Andrew, thanks for the call. We just have a minute or so left. Cheryl, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a conservative issue because we were specifically talking about the conservative backlash. I agree with you. As athletes, certainly you want to be focused on the game. And I think a great way of doing that would be for sports leagues and organizations to stop requiring the national anthem to be played before games. I think another really great way to remove politics from sports is for politicians who are running for the highest office in the country to stop commenting on what players are not doing. That would be another example or strategy. I think, though, the idea that, athletes can somehow disconnect themselves and their identities from who they are as athletes is maybe one that athletes from privileged backgrounds or identities might have an easier time doing. So how does an athlete who's queer, openly trans, sort of not think about these kind of larger issues, particularly when they're part of the contemporary cultural landscape?
Thanks for the call. Andrew and Cheryl, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Cheryl Cookie, Professor of American Studies and Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies at Purdue University. We've been talking about the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team's early exit from the World Cup and the wave of conservative criticism it brought on related to players and the team's political and social viewpoints. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, this week's edition of Food Friday, find out how to overcome picky eating. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Now, the plaintiffs in a landmark climate change case in Montana have won, potentially setting precedent in other states. The youth plaintiffs in Held versus Montana argued that the state deprived them of their right granted in their own state constitution to a clean and healthy environment. Plaintiffs, represented by the group Our Children's Trust, argued that the state deprived them of this right by promoting the use of fossil fuels and by explicitly outlawing the consideration of climate change when considering new energy projects. An appeal is expected. The case, the ruling, is unprecedented, and it could have an impact on future environmental law elsewhere in the country. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of climate change lawsuits on behalf of young people? Do you think people should have constitutional rights to a clean and healthy environment, as states like Montana and a few others do? Would you want to see that in Wisconsin's state constitution? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Steph Tai is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School and associate dean for the UW-Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. Steph, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here as usual.
Before we dig into the particulars of this Montana case, it seems like I've been seeing this kind of lawsuit on behalf of younger people about climate change popping up here and there around the country. Are you seeing this as a growing tactic?
Yes. Our Children's Trust, the nonprofit that has been leading all of these cases, has been pretty active in a bunch of different states, both building on states that have constitutional requirements for consideration of the environment, but also leading different types of actions, not just against states themselves, but also against various companies, et cetera.
How big a deal is this ruling in this Montana lawsuit? Is this something that you think might reverberate elsewhere in the country?
Yeah, so there's a few other states that have similar kinds of rights in their constitution. I think Hawaii is one of them. And it's likely that this will set some kind of soft precedent for similar lawsuits in those cases. Now, it's important to be aware of what's involved in this case, mm-hmm. because the case doesn't compel the government to do anything affirmative to address climate change. But what it does do is the state court judge has said that the law that was passed by Montana that restricted agencies from reviewing the climate change impacts of their various actions, they said that that was unconstitutional according to the state constitution. And so that takes off the table this sort of veil of ignorance that was created by those laws. And furthermore, the judge said that that actually compelled agencies, the state constitution compels agencies to have to consider those effects when making things like permitting decisions for new power plants, making decisions like opening new kind of wells, all of those kinds of decisions.
Right. So you're keying in on some of the unique things of Montana where we might not have a similar lawsuit in Wisconsin. One, Montana's state constitution guarantees a healthful environment, clean and healthful environment to their residents. Wisconsin and most states don't do that. And this particular law saying, hey, you can't consider climate change in the decisions. A lot of states, of course, don't have that. How much of this hinged on those two very particular issues in a state like Montana?
Both of those were incredibly important to the decision here. For example, in Wisconsin, we don't have any bar against agencies considering climate change. And so there's been a number of lawsuits against the Public Service Commission for failure to adequately consider the impact of climate change on new permitting decisions for power plants. And so that wasn't ever taken off the table in Wisconsin. And it's true that while Wisconsin doesn't have the right to a clean and healthy environment, we do have some softer aspects of our Constitution that perhaps groups might try to use even more emphatically after this case. We have, for example, in Wisconsin, the public trust doctrine, which is limited to waters, but climate change can potentially affect the availability of waters. And we also have a right to hunt and fish in Wisconsin, and to the extent that a lawsuit can be geared up to claim that failure to consider the right to fish, hunt and fish, to consider climate change impact on the right to hunt and fish, that might also be an avenue that litigants could take.
Talking to Steph Tye from the UW Law School, Associate Dean for the UW Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, looking at this lawsuit. You may have seen the headlines out of Montana, a lawsuit on behalf of younger people challenging a law in that state that said state agencies couldn't consider climate change in evaluating energy development there. You can join in with your reactions, your thoughts, maybe your questions at 800-642-1234. And what do you think about that wider issue of strategy, really, of issuing lawsuits on behalf of younger people on the basis that they may be greatly affected by climate change down the road? Join in at 800-642-1234. And this idea, Steph, groups like Our Children's Trust, filing lawsuits on behalf of younger people trying to demonstrate that they in particular would feel harm of climate-related policies. How does that affect issues of things like standing in cases like these?
Yeah, so what's interesting is that Montana also has a somewhat unique aspect of its constitutional doctrine that says that young people also have this kind of special standing, that those under 18 are still available to bring these kinds of lawsuits. And this kind of right is protected in the Montana state constitution because the idea is that, you know, without that availability of lawsuits, then, you know, generations in the future will be missing a lot of key protections. And so I think part of that, too, is part of the overall strategy in bringing this case. Other states don't necessarily have that right laid out as Montana. And so some of that will sort of result in differences in some of the outcomes in different states.
Big picture climate change policy. Do you expect to see a lot of difference made by lawsuits like these, or are solutions more likely to come from legislative or executive actions?
I think it comes from a lot of them, right? So one thing that this case does say is it puts a halt on some of the legislation that is sort of anti-taking climate change action. That is, it will give future legislatures some pause in terms of passing laws saying you can't consider the impact of some kind of agency action on the environment. And so some of the sort of threat of climate change promoting legislation, basically fossil fuel promoting legislation. Some of that will be lessened, but I think that still further action still needs to be taken, not just in terms of the defense, which this is basically a defensive action, and more of an active kind of engagement. For example, California and New York have created these large climate change programs to ensure a shift in terms of their energy grid to more renewables. And I think Washington State is starting to do that. And so it takes not only defensive actions such as this, but also, I guess, offensive action, not offensive actions, but, you know, positive actions such as what's being done in some states.
We're talking about the victory of plaintiffs in a landmark climate case in Montana. Our guest is Steph Tighe, professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, associate dean for the UW-Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about this particular Montana youth climate case? Would you want to see similar action here in Wisconsin? How important do you think the courts are or should be when it comes to climate change? Wisconsin is not one of a handful of states with a so-called Green Amendment guaranteeing something like a clean and healthful environment as Montana does. Would you like it to be? Would you like to have that clause in the Constitution? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with UW-Madison Law Professor Steph Tighe about the victory of plaintiffs in a Montana youth climate change case, what it means for environmental litigation elsewhere in the country. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What role do you think young people should play in climate change activism? How about lawsuits on their behalf? What do you think of the idea of a state constitutional guarantee of a clean environment, a healthful environment, as Montana and a few other states have? Wisconsin does not have that clause. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Steph, we've got a handful of states, as I mentioned, with these environmental guarantees in their constitution. In addition to Montana, you've got Illinois, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, and Hawaii. Interesting mixed bag. Is there a movement to do this in more states, or was that something that just happened and then stopped happening across the country?
No, that's a great question. One of the difficulties is that many states are pretty locked in terms of being able to pass constitutional amendments. I don't remember the survey of how constitutional amendments are initiated, but it varies a lot from state to state. Some of them have to start off with petitions. Some of them have multiple methods. And so I think we've been seeing fewer constitutional amendments recently, but that might change. Again, part of that's going to depend on the electoral system in different states. And with various observations of gerrymandering going on in various states, I think that that will make it more difficult in some states to initiate these kind of constitutional changes.
Let's bring in a caller. Doug is with us in Colfax. Doug, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think it would be helpful to add that to the Wisconsin state constitution, given the climate change ramifications seem to be only getting worse. I would just like to add that I think, given that wind and solar are now cheaper forms of generating electricity than any other, that it would make sense for our state to just push for renewables, period, just because it makes financial sense.
Doug, thanks a lot for the call. And Steph, do you see the debate changing that way from we're talking about the environment and climate change to we're talking about economic impacts of alternative energy?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think part of the way in which climate change has gotten politicized ignores some of the real economic realities. I mean, even without a strong climate change policy in Wisconsin, we have shifted from in the 90s being around in the 80% reliance upon coal-generated electricity to now probably around, like, I think, 50%. Natural gas is much less expensive. Solar and wind are also less expensive. And so there's already some kind of economic reason to shift energy sources. And in some ways, the people fighting against it are fighting against what's actually technologically and economically more practical for everyone.
Thanks for that call. Nadia joins us now in Milwaukee. Nadia, hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm a recent college graduate, and I think as a young person, it's vitally important for Wisconsin to adapt this clause, and I'm hoping that the case in Montana sets some precedent so that we can adapt changes as soon as possible. I also don't think it's just the responsibility of our young people in Wisconsin. I think that parents and grandparents should be worrying about what our future is, and everybody should care less about perhaps how much it will cost now and how much we can gain from this economically in the future.
Nadia, thanks a lot for that call. Steph, do you see a growth in advocacy, whether it's actually in the courts or not, either by young people or, as Nadia says, on their behalf by parents and grandparents when it comes to environmental issues?
I absolutely agree with Nadia that it shouldn't just be born by the younger people, but I do see a huge growth in students interested in learning about and addressing climate change. When I first started teaching at UW Law School in 2006, there were students who were interested in environmental law, but they weren't focused specifically on climate change. Whereas now, like, I'm getting almost every student cares about it, and even students who are going into different areas of law. They're planning to go into being like a public defender or a prosecutor. They're planning on being like a housing lawyer. They're still caring about climate change. And so I think there is this real shift because we're seeing a lot of the actual changes appear before our eyes. And so, yes, I think it's changing. I'm sad that it's taken so long, and I'm sad that our generations let you down.
Nadia, thanks a lot for that call. Steph, we've been focusing on one particular piece of legislation, litigation, and a particular kind of lawsuit. Are there other environmental law issues you are focused on right now, especially related to climate change?
Yeah, so there's two aspects. So there's the litigation element of things, where there is litigation against not just this law, which prohibited the consideration of the impact of climate change, but also litigation on the sort of individual permit level, right? That's, I mentioned that in Wisconsin, that the Public Service Commission has to go through and approve of different permits. And so that's happening on the ground everywhere in different states. Allegations that state agencies are failing to fully consider the cost of climate change. And there's a lot of those cases are fairly successful. There's also cases involving the listing of endangered species because climate change creates a huge threat to them. So it happens in a lot of different areas. There's also sort of these private nuisance suits against individual companies for their contributions to climate change. And so I would say that, yes, those are a lot of different kind of active areas of litigation. At the same time, there's also legislation, like, for instance, the Inflation Reduction Act, that is trying to push more money towards mitigation-related measures and adaptation-related measures. And so we have to think about all of those in the legal mix as well. And then finally, there's, I want to sort of bring up also how there are private companies that are actually trying to affirmatively respond to concerns about climate change and sort of making these sorts of commitments to reduce their own carbon footprints. And many of those are working with what we often don't think of as legal structures because it's not like lawsuits, but what they're doing is they're crafting different types of contracts to ensure that their entire supply chain is abiding by certain types of standards to lower their carbon footprint. And so there's all of that out there that's happening right now.
Steph, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Steph Tye is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School and associate dean for the UW Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. We've been talking about a landmark climate change case called Held versus Montana. A group representing young plaintiffs there challenged a state law under their state constitution. We've been talking about youth lawsuits there and elsewhere in the country. If you have thoughts on that, if you've participated in something like this or someone you know has, love to hear your story. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Formerly incarcerated people who struggle with opioid addictions are at a high risk of overdosing when they're released from prison. In Milwaukee County, a substance abuse treatment program combines medication and drug counseling to try to reduce those risks. Evan Casey has more on how that program helped one man change his life.
5 years ago, David Stockton was strung out on heroin, homeless, and sleeping in a tent in downtown Milwaukee. Now, he's almost 1 year sober.
I'm at the point in my life where I'm doing this for me. And that's really the only way it works.
In 2011, Stockton injured his back while working. He was prescribed opioids for the pain. But soon, he was hooked. The 45-year-old Richfield native says he spent time in prison last year after he was convicted of writing bad checks to help pay for his addiction. But today, Stockton says he's sober because of a medication-assisted treatment program he started while he was still behind bars. That program is called Behind the Walls.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know where I'd be today if it wasn't for this opportunity.
The program is a public-private partnership that operates inside the Milwaukee County Community Reintegration Center. Stockton received drug treatment counseling as well as prescription medications that help him stay clean. One helps relieve withdrawal symptoms. Another drug that's sometimes prescribed is called naltrexone. It blocks the sedative effects of opioids. That means even if someone were to use, they wouldn't get high. Jennifer Whitwer is the director of Milwaukee County's Community Access to Recovery Services Department. She says before the program started in 2019, the prison didn't offer treatment for inmates.
The best that we could do before this program was that we would get people connected to medication-assisted treatment services the day of their release. But often, that was too late.
A 2018 study found that after release, former inmates were 40 times more likely to die of an overdose compared to someone in the general population. That's just one reason Whitwer says the program is essential.
They're in a correctional facility they can't use, and it gives people an opportunity to really reevaluate where they're at in their life and what they want their life to look like post-incarceration.
Inmates have to have a documented substance abuse disorder and volunteer for the program. When they're released, they continue their treatment at a local clinic. That's where people like Amy Malinsky with Community Medical Services come in.
Being able to get somebody started in treatment while they're already in custody and having a plan for them, an intake appointment scheduled, like everything ready to go for their day of release, we're relieving so much of that burden off of the individual.
Milwaukee's program got a large chunk of cash this year from a historic settlement with opioid manufacturers that'll help pay for it for several more years. Earlier this summer, Stockton showed visitors around the Fourth Dimension Sobriety Home.
So, yeah, as you can see, this used to be a school. So we got the little jungle gym. But yeah, we've got a little bonfire area.
He's been living at the home for just over 8 months now. He came here as a resident, but now he's a manager, and he takes pride in helping others. He recently helped organize a cookout with other sober living homes in the area.
Being in recovery, it's a community, and we like to bring people together.
For Stockton, expanding treatment options for inmates is a matter of life and death.
With the proper guidance, the proper motivation, the proper medication, that brought me to a place where I found my self-worth. And that goes a long way.
On Saturday, Stockton will celebrate his 46th birthday. The next day, he'll celebrate 1 year of sobriety. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Follow Evan and our great news team over at WPR.org/news. You can read stories, listen to stories, and share them with others. Find it all at WPR.org. We can also live stream this network, our other network, and search through our archives of talk programs as well. Find it all over at WPR.org.